The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
The last few weeks, when I've been offering talks here, I've been talking about the hindrances, states of mind that tend to get in our way in terms of settling the mind, in terms of being present in our daily lives, in our meditation. And so these hindrances are the states of sense desire, ill will, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt. And last week I talked about doubt, and we explored doubt, thinking perhaps the teaching indicates we explore the edges of doubt. We explore what are we confused about? What do we not know? What do we not believe? There's doubts we have in teachers and teachings. Can I do this? And so I talked about that last week. But at the end, what I came to, or what the piece that I opened to, is that sometimes there are things that we doubt, that we're not sure about, that are actually appropriate to doubt. And that's the topic I'd like to explore a little bit today. How do we work with it when there are things that are appropriate to doubt? And what kinds of ways do we go about finding our way in that? The Buddha actually gave a talk about this. At least in the West, it's a sutta that people refer to quite a bit. It's sometimes called the Kalama Sutta. It's a discourse that the Buddha gave to a group of people called the Kalamas. They lived in an area of India where there were these crossroads of a lot of people traveling these crossroads. And in the living on those crossroads, a lot of different teachers came to town. And they expressed a lot of different teachings. Some would say one thing and say, this is what's true. And then another person would come to town and say the opposite thing and would say, this is what's true. And they would basically say, this is what's true and anything else is false, it's wrong. And so the people in this town, hearing these various teachers, getting the kind of variety of teachers, kind of like in California, we have so many different teachers and offerings here. We're kind of at the crossroads here. These people, when the Buddha came to town, they decided to take a different tack. They decided, rather than asking him, so what do you teach? They said, we have all these teachers come to town and they say one thing and then they tell us that the other people are full of it and they don't know what they're talking about. And then these other people come to town and they tell us that the other people were full of it and they don't know what they're talking about. And like, we don't know what to believe. We don't know what to do. We have doubt. Here's what they said to the Buddha. There are some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta. They explain and elucidate their own teachings, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. But then other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, denigrate, deride, and denounce the doctrines of others. We are perplexed and in doubt, Bhante, as to which of these good ascetics speak the truth and which speak falsehood. And the Buddha responds, the first thing he says, it is fitting for you to be perplexed. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. So this is a place where the Buddha doesn't just say, well, don't have doubt. He's asking us to begin to look at our questions. Look at what our views are. Look at views that are presented by other people. And to begin to just not take things that other people say as necessarily as fact or as truth, but to begin to investigate. And so he offers some guidelines for investigation. But the first thing he does in offering these guidelines is he says things that we should not just go by. I don't think in this he's dismissing these as being irrelevant in our exploration, but as things that are not to say we hold these up as the source of our truth. He says, and this is broken into kind of roughly three different categories, don't just base your beliefs on tradition, based on things people have said, on a lineage, on a popular opinion or general consent, or on a collection of teachings. So this is actually, when we think about this, I mean, that I think to reflect on this a little more deeply, how do we, in our lives, take up beliefs? Do we take up beliefs based on what the general population believes? Do we take up beliefs based on tradition? So this is kind of this terrain, the area of transmitted tradition. And this is a way that we sometimes believe things. It's like we don't question things at times when it's like, well, everybody else believes that it must be true. And so the Buddha is saying, I don't think he's saying don't believe what you hear. I think he's saying oral tradition, popular opinion, maybe not such a reliable source of truth or fact. There could be truth in what people offer there, but it probably needs to be investigated. Another area, he says, this one hits a little closer to home. Based on our own reasoning, don't necessarily go based on what we think. So he says, based on logical reasoning, inferential reasoning, reflection on our reasons, or acceptance after review after we've thought about it. Again, all in this terrain of using our minds, using our reflective capacity, using our thought. Well, this sounds like it makes sense, this view. It sounds feasible or logical, or and so this notion of using our intellect to decide this is true. And again, I don't think he's dismissing this as being irrelevant. There's too many other places in the suttas where he asks us to reflect and asks us to use our capacities for rational thought to explore what's happening. But he is pointing to perhaps that it's not, that it's, first of all, I think that it's not necessarily a reliable source of truth, the way we think about things. And part of the reason for that is that it's so easy for the way we think about things, for our processes of reflection, to be influenced by our preferences. So we like something. We like the way something makes us feel, and so we tend to find reasons why, you know, without even being aware of it, we may find reasons why we think that's a good thing. It's just a support, you know, this works in life, so this is a good thing. It's just our reasoning will tend to support what we like. Somebody, it may be, I can't remember who pointed to this, but that so much of our reasoning, our rational powers of thought, aren't really going based on raw data, that they're actually basically affirming what we already like in our experience. The views, it's like, well, what we don't like, it's like, well, this is right because I like it, or this is wrong because I don't like it. There's actually a lot of that happens. And so within our reasoning powers are often influenced by our emotions. And I think this is a piece of why the Buddha says, don't necessarily trust this, because it can be skewed. Our reasoning powers can be skewed. The last piece, he says, not to just say, okay, I will go based on this, is based on the authority of a teacher. You know, say that this speaker sounds like they know what they're talking about, so I should believe them. Or this person is our teacher, so I need to believe them. So the again, you know, kind of undermining these 10 ways he listed in these three categories are undermining the ways that we typically would come to believe things or come to accept something as true. So this is an interesting question for us. You know, what are the ways that we take things to be true? To begin to, I think part of the encouragement of this teaching is to reflect on this, to reflect on what is it that we believe to be true? And how are we coming to that belief? And are we then saying, based on that belief, this is truth? This is a distinction, you know, when we can actually acknowledge, this is my belief. That's different from saying, this is the truth, and everything else is wrong. One of the interesting ways the Buddha talked about truth, he talked about preserving the truth being very important. Preserving truth, kind of beginning to move towards truth. But the way he talked about it wasn't so much, this is true. He said, to preserve truth, when we experience something that we believe, when we have a belief, we acknowledge, this is my belief. That's preserving the truth, because that's the truth of what's happening, is that there's a belief happening. The truth for the Buddha isn't so much about ideas about reality, isn't so much about the models that we construct about experience or about reality, but the truth that the Buddha is pointing to is the truth of the moment, the truth of what's actually happening right here and right now. This is the truth that the Buddha was pointing to. How do we come into contact with what's actually happening in this moment? And one of the ways we can do that to preserve truth, the truth of the moment, is to acknowledge when there's a belief arising, this is belief, as opposed to this is truth. There's a vast difference between those two. And this can happen in so many ways in simple ways that we believe, we take as truth certain of our thoughts. Like, you know, I really bought into the thought that I was miserable, that I was a miserable person. That, you know, that's just who I was. It seemed to be my truth. With that, buying into that belief, and it was really a belief that was being taken to be truth, that that's just who I was, that there wasn't a way to change it. Buying into that belief, there wasn't much room for anything else to happen. Even when I wasn't miserable, you know, even when I was happy. I mean, I did experience happiness, but, you know, when I was happy, the mind would say something like, well, yeah, but I know that I'm really miserable. I'm happy now, but that's not who I am. Happiness, that's just fleeting. Miserable, that's permanent. That's who I am. And so there was a taking that emotional reality to be a truth. When we can start to acknowledge to ourselves, this is the emotional reality right now. This is the experience, the miserableness is arising right now, and believing that it's who I am is happening right now. There's a difference between that and buying into the reality of being a miserable person. And just acknowledging, and this is very powerful, if you find areas where you're really stuck, certain patterns or habits that come up a lot, if you find areas where you're really stuck, acknowledging, oh, this is what's being believed right now. It's in line with what's happening in the moment. I mean, sometimes what we try to do, like I've seen teachings and practices around this where it's like, well, just tell yourself you're happy. Look at yourself in the mirror and tell yourself that you love yourself. I tried that for a while with this miserableness. I tried doing that. But the part of my mind that believed in the miserable was saying, yeah, right. You know, this is just a bunch of new age stuff. It's not. And so the belief in the miserable was so strong that the mind wasn't going to let in anything else. But what we sometimes can do is acknowledge miserableness is a belief. It creates a little crack in the mind, a little crack in the experience that has us acknowledging in that moment, this is a belief in this moment. There are conditions that are arising that create this belief in this moment. And it is a belief. So acknowledging that it's a belief leaves the door open to some other possibility entering in. And so the truth that the Buddha is pointing to is really the truth of the moment. And this is what he actually points to in the next part of this teaching. He says, it's interesting. So after saying don't go by tradition or reasoning or personal authority, he says, when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome. These things are blameworthy. These things are censured by the wise. These things, if undertaken, lead to harm and suffering. Then you should abandon them. Stop practicing them. Try to let them go. And then he says on the flip side, when you know for yourself these things are wholesome, these things are beneficial, these things are praised by the wise, these things, when undertaken and practiced, lead to happiness and welfare, then you should practice them. You should live in accordance with those. And so he offers some guidelines here, not about, I think this is interesting. I actually just realized this last night as I was rereading this sutta. He's not offering guidance on how to decide if something is true or false. He's offering guidance on look at your experience and see, does it lead to suffering? Does this action, when practiced, lead to harm of others or myself? Does this action, when practiced, lead away from harm, lead towards happiness and welfare? And he suggests looking, first of all, in our own experience, this reflection on do these actions lead to happiness or suffering? And then it's not about evaluating truth in that moment. It's about practicing what leads to happiness, letting go of what leads to suffering. So he kind of takes a left turn here. It's like he's not saying, well, here's how you decide what's true and what's false. He says, look at what you're practicing in the moment. Does it lead to happiness? Does it lead to suffering? And then he checks in with them because even this teaching, he offers some guidelines for us here. He says, you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blameworthy, these things are censured by the wise, these things lead to harm or suffering. So several ways to explore it. It's not just, just that first one, if it was just like, these things are blameworthy. There's a lot of things that we may take as blameworthy that we've got all kinds of ideas about, views and opinions about, somebody earlier today was talking about having done something that led to a little more agitation in the mind. And she said, and I felt really guilty about that. You know, it's like, I shouldn't have done that. And it's like, well, you know, maybe in those conditions, what you did led to more agitation in the mind. But blameworthy, creating guilt around it, is not so useful. And so to just simply use our own ideas of what's blameworthy may not be enough. And so he offers some other guidelines. He offers the question of, is this leading to harm or suffering? And so does what's happening in our experience, is it creating suffering for others? Is it creating harm for others? Is it creating harm for ourselves? Using that as something of a guideline. Although even there, you know, and these things when are praised by the wise or censured by the wise, another guideline for us to kind of take in people that we understand as wise. We can use their information also. And so to some extent, he's bringing back some of these reflections, the using our reflections, using our teachings, our teachers. And yet it's in a context of investigating, not just taking it in and saying, oh, somebody says that must be true. Oh, I think this must be true. But using that information and then testing it in our experience. And does it lead to suffering or does it lead to welfare and happiness? So that really is the test for us. Does what we're exploring, do the states of mind, the ways that we are motivated, do they lead to suffering or to happiness? And then the Buddha actually offers a little bit of reflections. He asks them questions. He asks these the Kalamas some questions. He says, how about greed? When greed arises in your mind, is that helpful for yourself or for others or for both? He said, when greed arises, is it for welfare or harm? And these people actually had some sense of a developed ethical sensibility. There are definitely people who, when asked that question, might say, well, when greed arises, it's for my welfare. You might think that. When greed arises, I act on that, I get what I want, and, you know, that makes me happy. But when we actually start investigating not just, like, the outcome of greed, which may or may not be getting what you want, it may or may not be that, when we let go of looking at evaluating the welfare or happiness about greed based on the outcome, which is kind of habitually how we might evaluate welfare. It's like, oh, do I get what I want? Then that's for my welfare. If I do this stuff, I get lots of money, then that's my welfare. That's for my welfare. Or if I do these things, I get this thing or get this status that I want, then that's for my welfare. But the Buddha, again, points us right back into the present moment. And these people that he was talking to seem to have an appreciation of this piece of the teaching. That's a part of the Buddha's teaching, again, pointing us into the present moment. When greed is arising in the present moment, if you feel into right now, just like something that you want, if you just like imagine in your mind something that you want, but then let go of the thing that you want and feel into the state of the wanting itself. What is that experience of the wanting itself? Suffering. It feels out of balance. It's like as soon as wanting springs up, there's a feeling of lack. Wanting creates a feeling of lack that it believes, that wanting believes needs to be filled by the thing that it wants. So that wanting has the story that get this thing and happiness will be there. And yet, the story of wanting is not aware or not actually pointing us into in this moment. And again, this is where the Buddha was saying, this is where welfare lives. In this moment, nowhere else. This is all there is anyway. You know, any idea of I'll get something in the future, we are basically abandoning happiness here and now. when we are believing that, well, if I follow through on this, if I follow through on this wanting, if I do these things and get that thing, then I'll be happy. You may get a little bit of happiness in that moment. You might get a little bit of happiness for getting the thing that you want. But in the next moment or two or three, you might find that, well, I got that thing. You know, the last time I was really happy was when I got what I wanted. So what do I want now? How can I get another moment of getting what I want? And so we end up kind of in a cycle, a perpetuating cycle, not aware that we're just continually essentially letting ourselves be out of balance, be in this state of a feeling of lack. And so the Buddha pointed us back into the present moment. When greed arises in the present moment, is that welfare in the present moment? When greed is present in the present moment, is there a sense of welfare and happiness in the present moment when wanting is in the present moment? No. It feels off. It feels like suffering. Now, in exploring this teaching, you might think, well, if I never wanted anything, why would I do anything? You know, why would I ever, how would I live life if I didn't want anything? This is the story of wanting. You know, wanting is telling us that I'm necessary. I'm needed. You have to have me because you wouldn't do anything unless I was here. But there are wholesome forms of action. We can act based on compassion, based on love, based on wisdom, based on balance of mind. Wisdom is, greed is not going to tell you that. Greed is not going to tell you if I disappear, there will be another kind of motivation that arises from compassion or kindness or joy or generosity or wisdom. So this, you know, I think this is a place we fear a little bit. If that greed goes away, if that wanting goes away, won't I just like be sitting like a lump on the log? Why would I ever do anything? But that's the story of wanting telling us that. It takes, this is, you know, it does take a little bit of a trust. You know, what we are learning to trust in is the well-being of the present moment. Can we recognize that actually in seeing greed arising in the present moment, in seeing the off nature of that, the imbalanced feeling of lack that's happening there, you might try sometime for something that you want, something small. You know, you're driving down the road and you see a Starbucks sitting at a stoplight. You see a Starbucks, it's like, ooh, latte, that would be nice. You know, just something simple. Let yourself just watch the wanting. Commit yourself this time. I'm not going to follow through on that. And just watch. What does it feel like to want? You'll really get a taste of the offness of it, the unpleasant feeling of it. And then as you keep watching it, fortunately, wanting is a conditioned state of mind. It arises and it passes away. It will end. It will not last forever. That wanting for that latte will not last forever. Sooner or later, it will go away. And then when you, at some point, notice that it's gone, or even see it disappearing, you'll see that that offness around that particular suffering, that there was kind of like a belief in that moment of, yeah, I really needed that latte. That this the mind had just completely bought into happiness with the latte. It's really amazing what we think is going to make us happy. I mean, the mind will fully believe that in that state of wanting. So in seeing that that wanting goes away, we see, wow, I didn't actually have to have that latte in order to be okay. This is a simple little example, trivial little example, but it gives you a flavor of both the experience of wanting, the offness of it, and then the recognition when that wanting goes away of how it's not a problem anymore. And this is actually something that's, when we can actually watch a wanting for long enough, and I can do this on retreats. It's more recently I'm able to do it in daily life a little bit, to actually watch a wanting until it disappears. Just be with that feeling of offness, watching it, being with it. It's like, yeah, that I really want that thing, but oh, feeling into it, feeling the pull, feels like a gravitational pull to that thing. Just watching it, and then at some point the conditions will change and that wanting will go away. If you get to see that, if you see the wanting go away, in that moment you will get a visceral understanding of the well-being that's available when wanting is not present. I watched this on one, the first time I really saw this on one retreat, I was watching the construction of wanting, or greed around looking at people. And we'd been told not to look at people, not to look at people in the eyes during this 3-month retreat. So I wasn't looking at people, but I really wanted to. I really wanted to look at people. And so when anybody would come into my field of vision, be like, oh, I really want to look at them. But I was committed to not looking at people. And at some point I began to, at first it was just like, put on the blinders, I'm not going to do this. It was like, basically taking in, the teachers told me, I'm not supposed to do this, so I'm not going to do it. Kind of taking in that, this is truth, this is what the teaching is, I'm not supposed to do this. But then at some point I recognize, well, what's happening here? What's arising in the moment is greed, so that's what I should look at. I shouldn't just put the blinders on, I should feel into the greed. And when I started doing that, whole new understandings began to arise. I saw that the greed was constructed based on, I'd be walking somewhere, I'd just be walking happily, just doing my practice, and then somebody would appear in the field of periphery vision, and poof, the wanting would, boom, it would arise. Just feeling the conditioned nature of that wanting. It was not there a moment before, and seeing it come into be when the conditions of a person were there. And then just watching it actually get stronger as the person, you know, they'd start in the periphery and then they might like walk up there and be like, wow, I really want to look at them. The easier it gets, all I have to do is just shift my eyes a little bit and I could see them. You know, who is it? I think that's what it was. I really wanted to know who it was. So I wasn't looking, but I was feeling into that greed, feeling how strong it got. And then as they did their thing, this person moved through my field of vision and then disappeared, went into the building, that wanting vanished. Just vanished. And in that moment, it felt like I'd been released from a vice grip, the vice grip of wanting. And in that moment, I got a really clear recognition that, wow, a lot of the happiness that comes when we get what we want is that unpleasant feeling of wanting goes away. It's not just about getting what we want. The feeling of wanting itself feels so unpleasant that we want it to go away. And the getting is the only way that we habitually know of how to make that feeling of wanting go away. But that just conditions more wanting. And so when we recognize, actually, the wanting can go away without getting what it wants, that's a hugely powerful recognition. And so this is the well-being, again, the well-being in the present moment, in seeing the wanting vanish, the well-being and happiness that arises right there. That's the pointer that the Buddha was talking about. That's what he's suggesting is more trustable. The experience of the well-being with the release of suffering. And we approximate our way to this well-being. You know, we find certain places or states where, there's contraction around this kind of wanting or aversion, this confusion, there's contraction. And then, you know, we let it go a little bit and there's a little bit of more feeling of well-being. And so we kind of begin to, it's like, well, let's trust that. What happened there? It's like, I can see there's wanting arising and I can just be present with it. There's more of a sense of well-being. I can just watch it. I don't have to believe it. There's a little space around it. And so we begin to trust a a little bit that direction. And so this is what the Buddha is suggesting, that we look at what leads to our welfare and happiness in the present moment. This is what I think he's pointing to. Evaluating our actions, our choices, based on how they impact our experience right now. And it is a teaching. I mean, it is the Buddha offering a teaching, but he doesn't say, hey, believe me. He says, try it. Come and see for yourself. Is this useful? I love this. This is a word, come and see. It's in the Pali, ehi pasi ko, and it's basically an invitation to try the teachings for yourselves. The Dharma of the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, are not meant to just be believed. They are meant to be explored, testing them out in our own experience. Are they useful? Do we find ourselves moving towards more well-being as we practice them? For me, in my first like 3 months of practice, I did not trust these teachings, because the teaching basically said, pay attention to your difficult emotions. Like I was like ruled by my anger, so miserable. And I read something of the Buddhist teachings. A friend sent me a book because they knew I was really miserable. I said, here, try this. This might help. Read this book. And in reading the book, it said something like, well, try being aware while you're angry, or try being aware while you're miserable. Know that you're miserable while you're miserable. I'm like, how's that going to, what the heck is that going to do for me? That's just going to make me worse, isn't it? But in some ways, fortunately, I had hit bottom. I had tried everything I could think of. And it's like, hey, nothing else has worked. What have I got to lose? So I tried it. And that step back, basically the exploration isn't wallow in the miserableness. It's, this is what it's like to be a human being that feels miserable. This is what it's like to be a human being that feels angry. And that's what I began exploring. Within a few weeks, I understood the value of that for myself. I no longer had to take it on faith. I no longer had to simply believe. Well, I didn't even believe it, but I was willing to try it. And then in that, having it confirmed for myself, oh, this is actually helpful. I actually see that I'm no longer so caught by that reactive emotion. There's a little more space around it. I've got more room to navigate. When it comes up, I can know it's there, and then I can also do other things. It's like the whole of my world doesn't become that miserableness and anger. There's space to move. And then seeing, you know, within 3 months, very clear insights and recognitions around how that anger was created and what options there were in the mind to be in a different place, to be in a different state. So very quickly, you know, just even hearing these teachings, you know, it's like, look for yourself, look in the present moment. How does this impact you in the present moment? My understanding, some of how this worked for me in this exploration, was that turning towards the experience of anger in the present moment, what happened was I got a really good lesson in, boy, that hurts. Anger does not feel good in the present moment. Again, this is what the Buddha is talking about. When he goes on, not just when greed arises, is it for your harm? When aversion arises, is it for your harm? What I began to understand with this is that the view behind the anger that I had, I was really angry at somebody. They had done me wrong. I really bought into that story, and I think I believed that they needed to do something different in order for me to be happy. I needed to figure out either that, or I had to make them miserable, and then I could be happy. Something along those lines. So what I got, though, when I just started to pay attention in the moment is like, wow, this really hurts. There's a teaching around aversion in the text that says aversion is like picking up a hot coal, or anger. I think it's actually anger. Anger is like picking up a hot coal. You're picking up a hot coal to throw it at somebody else to burn them, but you burn yourself first. And what happens, though, is because we're so focused on wanting to make the other person miserable, wanting them to suffer, we miss the fact that we are suffering ourselves. And so this exploration, when anger arises in the present moment, is it for my welfare or harm? What I saw is that I had believed it had been for my welfare. It's kind of stunning to think I actually had believed that anger had been for my welfare. But the direct experience was, no, this is not for my welfare. And so the learning was immediate and direct. I didn't have to believe what somebody told me. I got it in the moment. I got it for myself. This is not for my welfare. And as the system gets that, as the system begins to understand, this is not for my welfare, what I experienced over days or months actually was that understanding that anger was not for my welfare, as the mind saw itself heading in that direction, it was like, I know where that's going. That doesn't feel good. And it wasn't like even a thing I had to abandon. I didn't have to do the abandoning. It's like the system knew. The system knew that hurts. It's kind of like you touch a pot on a stove that's hot and your system knows that's dangerous and it burns. Kind of similarly, as we get the information through being aware in the present moment, anger burns. The mind begins to understand how to let it go and how to not go there. It's a slow process, but it begins by this being willing to, this is what it's like to be a human being that feels this way. So the Buddha suggests looking in our own experience, what things are helpful, what things are not helpful. Does it lead to welfare in the moment? Does it lead to happiness in the moment? And what leads to the conditions that lead to happiness in the moment, this is another kind of leap of faith in a way that we have to learn to trust. And this trust comes over time, I think, that taking care of the present moment, taking care of our well-being in the present moment is the best way to ensure our well-being in future moments. Our greed, our aversion does not believe that story, does not believe that. And yet, because of the information around greed and aversion being so much suffering in the present moment, when we get that, really, the mind begins to trust that letting go of this is probably going to be helpful. At least it feels better in the present moment. But then we begin to see, in practicing that, the benefits that come over time. As we cultivate well-being in the present moment, we're cultivating qualities and conditions that support our future well-being as well. We're cultivating qualities of compassion and love and kindness and mindfulness and stability of mind. We're cultivating those that support us to be able to meet whatever happens. And so the Buddha ends this teaching by basically saying, again, you know, it doesn't so much matter what you believe. And he's addressing, in a sense, some of the beliefs that were being presented to those people, to the Kalamas and the various teachers that came and said, believe this, don't believe that. Believe this, this is true. If you don't believe this, then you're going to hell, you know, that kind of thing. Or, you know, believe this. And a lot of those had to do with believing in future lives or believing in or not believing in future lives. You know, this is the end of it. You know, you die, it's over, you know, or this isn't the end of it. You get reborn forever, or, you know, you do these things, you go to heaven, you do these things, you go to hell. You know, those kinds of teachings, believe this, you know, this. And there's some of this kind of flavor of the teaching in what the Buddha teaches also. But he keeps pointing us back not to believe those things so much, not to say that's truth, but to come back, what is supportive in the present moment? What leads to welfare and happiness right now? This is all there is anyway. this moment, there's no past. All that there is of the past are thoughts that are arising now in the present moment. The past is done. It's gone. It's not there anymore. The future isn't here either. It doesn't exist yet. All there is right now. And again, the Buddha is pointing us to take care of now. Find the way to well-being now. And that will support your well-being in the future. But he says you don't have to necessarily believe this. He said just, you know, explore for yourself what's going on. Your system, as you begin to make this exploration, your system will begin to gravitate towards well-being. I think in many ways, it's fortunate, you know, our mind and body is put together in a way that it wants happiness, it wants well-being, it wants ease. But there's so many processes in our mind that are confusing and deluding us, like the wanting, telling us, yes, if you get this in the future, you'll feel good. In the future, right now you feel like really bad, but in the future you'll feel good. And when we're believing that story, we're abandoning our happiness here and now for some idea of happiness in the future. So we begin to, you know, just trust in this present moment experience, trust in the well-being of this moment. He closes with these assurances, you know, again, not based on belief. He says, well, you know, you might believe there's a future life. He says, if you think there is a future life and that... you know, that your actions have consequences in this life and the next life, then behaving skillfully now will help you in the future. But if you don't believe in a future life, your well-being here and now is really impacted by this practice, by exploring this, by being here and being present. And so whether you believe in future births or not, happiness here and now is available. And he says, and if there is a future life, he says it's like, you know, you win on both counts. You know, if there is a future life, you win there. If there's not, you win here. So he's proposing that we try this exploration of coming into the present moment and evaluating based on well-being and welfare here and now. This takes some training. It takes some skill. But, you know, as my experience in daily life around all of that exploration around anger, I did that in daily life. And it just came from reading this book that said, try paying attention to your anger rather than acting on it. You know, just to be aware. Be aware. It's like, I don't even know how to do that. But that pointer to just take in, how does anger, are you experiencing anger right now? It's a very simple instruction. Very deep impact on our lives and on our experience. So this is my understanding of what I think the Buddha is really pointing to here. This evaluation of, is it creating welfare or suffering now? What's happening in your experience? Is it creating welfare or happiness now? So, questions, comments, thoughts? Yeah, John, behind you.
You have a very strong practice. Do you have any doubt in this moment right now? That's kind of...
There are different kinds of doubt. There are different kinds of doubts. I don't have doubt in the capacity of these teachings to lead to freedom, to lead to suffering. I mean, to lead away from suffering. I don't have doubt in that possibility. I'm not experiencing it in this moment, that full freedom. So there are doubts here. I mean, there's some forms of I wouldn't say doubt so much as delusion. There's delusion here.
Are you familiar with St. John of the Cross and his writings, The Dark Night of the Soul? because he was clearly like God-centric. And so he, when he lost that, he had, I guess he had doubt. So why do people like that have doubt?
Well, that's a different tradition, so not sure I can really address that so much. But you know, there is a kind of a similar thing in the Buddhist practice where the practice moves through this terrain where it feels like basically there's no control. You know, we really move into a place of understanding how little control we actually have. And that creates a space in the mind of fear, confusion. It's like, hey, wait a minute, I've been like working to try, I've been doing things to try to like be present and to like let go of greed and cultivate wholesome states. And now I see like I don't really have that control. It's like there's a sense a little bit of losing confidence there. And there's a feeling of nothing to land on, and how do I do this? And the instruction there is to just keep going, you know, just keep notice that it is, notice that it feels like there's nowhere to land. Notice that it's fearful. Notice that it feels confused. You know, just again, it's like what's happening now? This space of. They call it the dark night in the Buddhist tradition too, the dark night of the soul. Sometimes they call it that, just like I think because it's a very similar place where you lose a sense of confidence that there's any control. And maybe it's similar too. It's like, you know, you really have to give yourself over, I think, at that place. You have to give yourself over to trust. And that's what has to happen at that moment in this practice too. You have to trust in the unfolding experience that there is no control, but you just have to trust in the unfolding of it and the awareness of the unfolding of it. Yeah. And, well, we have a minute. One more. Just if it's a minute.
It's a minute. Okay. Two unrelated comments. First one is, there was a book I read a year ago, which for the purposes of our discussion, the only thing that's important is really the title. It happens to be about this woman's departure from evangelical Christianity. But the title of the second edition is Trusting Doubt.
There is something like that. And as you know, there's what I would say there is not trusting doubt, but trusting the unknown. Mm. Because there's often a feeling of doubt when there's something that we don't know. Mm. And every moment, and this is, I think, part of that place that I was just describing, every moment you are viscerally in the place of recognizing you have no idea what's coming next. Death may be coming next, or you just have no idea. It's just like you're so right in the present moment that you recognize that the next moment is completely unknown. And yet you have to step into, you have no choice, you step into it anyway. And there's a trust that has to be available to step into that unknown.
Yes, the willingness to investigate.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think there was a online community, which is now gone, called the Sangha of Skeptical Buddhism. It's now been absorbed into the broader online community of secular Buddhism. But it was around in the early 2000s a lot. And I think they're mostly critical of some of the more metaphysical esoteric aspects, but
there are definitely aspects like even rebirth, you know, yeah. in certain, you know, but for some people rebirth is very easy to believe in, for others not. And I would just again point back to, you know, with some of these metaphysical things, if you believe them or not, it's like, well, this is my belief,
yeah.
This is my disbelief,
yeah.
You know, that's how we preserve the truth.
Okay. The other thing I was going to say is sometimes when I actually do get what I want, which sometimes happens, I then try to cultivate a detachment from it so that I don't appropriate it into my ego. I don't see it as now a possession that I got. It's just something that I was there in the presence of. It's just something that's present to me, but it's not something that I in some sense own, so
yes.
That it doesn't actually build up
yeah.
the the ego. So I try
the sense of ownership, letting go of
the sense of ownership. I try not to develop a sense of ownership about it. So I do. That is something I practice when I actually do get what I want.
That's helpful. That's a very helpful practice. So we need to stop now. So thank you. I injured my back.